Part 2. The Investigation Begins. Chapter 12. Science. The National Institute for Discovery Science, NIDS, was an ambitious undertaking. Never before had a scientific organization been created and, more important, funded in order to bring scientific rigor to what was essentially paranormal research. When I saw the NIDS ad looking for interested scientists in the prestigious journal Science, I leaped at the chance to do revolutionary science in an area where few scientists had previously ventured. In answering the recruitment ad, the words of one of my postdoctoral mentors came to mind. If you want to catch a big fish, the best way is to fish in waters that are unpopulated by other fishermen. Within a few months of joining this brand new organization in the summer of 1996, I began to see NIDS as a way to roll back the frontiers of discovery science while working with some of the most brilliant people I had ever met. In addition to the two PhD scientists working with me, NIDS had a world-class, multidisciplinary advisory board that had been carefully handpicked from an array of disciplines in mainstream science. NIDS wanted to bring as broad a range of expertise and technology as possible to bear on UFOs and other problems that mainstream science had thus far ignored. The study of so-called paranormal events had always been starved of funding, and NIDS, which was started by Las Vegas real estate tycoon Bob Bigelow, was designed to remedy that situation. Shortly after NIDS staff was hired, we heard about what was happening on the Gorman Ranch. The opportunity it presented seemed ideal. The idea of a field station or laboratory in the wild that would bring all NIDS resources to bear to study it gained traction and quickly came to fruition. Within a few short weeks, NIDS bought the Gorman Ranch in Utah. The Gorman family was finally free to leave the property on which they had been held hostage for more than 18 months. They purchased a small ranch 25 miles away, and Ellen, Tom, and the children quickly made it their home. At the time, they told me that they wouldn't care if they never set foot on their old ranch again. There was fear mixed with revulsion in their reaction. Three of the Gormans were supremely happy to move on and to bring this part of their lives to a close. But Tom Gorman was not quite ready to do so. He's a proud man and was outraged at being thrown off his land by something he didn't understand. In the space of 18 to 20 months, someone or something had killed or stolen 14 registered cattle out of a herd of 80 animals, an attrition rate approaching 20%. Each of the animals was worth a couple $1,000s. Economically, the family was devastated. Even with such high-end cattle, the profit margin for ranching was slim. But in addition to the financial losses, Gorman's family had been reduced to barely surviving automatons because of stress and sleep deprivation. Their kids' grades had suffered drastically in school, and they were the butt of jokes in the community once the media took an active interest in their story. Within a couple of weeks of the transfer of ownership, Tom decided to take a job as the NIDS ranch manager to help us come to grips with who or what had run him off his land. NIDS purchased a few dozen cows, and Tom kept several more on the property to be used as bait. With remarkable self-discipline, Gorman arrived at what had been his property every day. Once he had been the owner, now he was an employee. He took care of the animals, supervised the irrigation, mended the broken fences, and joined the scientific teams on watches that sometimes lasted all night. On other nights, Tom returned to his family. The pace was grueling for Tom. While his family rested, his stubborn refusal to allow the phenomenon to get the best of him drove him onward. He was determined to find out more about what had terrorized his family. I will never forget my first sight of the ranch. The team had flown up in early September 1996 to reconnoiter the area before moving the observation trailer laboratory onto the property. It was a clear, sunny day as we drove the narrow half-mile track that ends up at the homestead where the Gormans had suffered so many sleepless nights. On our right, the red sandstone ridges jutted into the sky. I was struck by the wildness and pastoral beauty of these Utah badlands. When I first set foot on the ranch, I had the unmistakable feeling that something was not quite right. Things were not what they seemed. Everything looked beautiful as Tom took us on the tour on that first day. We briefly met Ellen and the kids. They looked exhausted, with white faces and dark-rimmed red eyes. Only later would I learn from Tom the extent of the trauma that his family had suffered. The ranch looked spectacularly gorgeous that day. The trees had not yet shed their blooms, and the cattle grazed peacefully in the fields. At the same time, in marked contrast to the serene environment, I could not shake an eerie feeling. Was I being watched? As a scientist, I immediately put this feeling down to the hype and the expectation about the place, but as a human being, I knew the feeling went deeper than that. Needless to say, I did not mention it until much later. Tom then took us on a tour. We began walking west, and the first stop brought us close to his fence line. He showed us the carcasses of two of his neighbor's cows that had gone missing a few days previously and had just been found in unlikely positions beneath the barbed wire fence that separated the two properties. Even from 50 yards away, the air was heavy with the stench of decaying flesh, the sound of thousands of buzzing flies as they landed in the open mouths, sightless eyes, and every available orifice and exposed soft tissues of the carcasses was almost deafening. The animals lay within 30 yards of each other, with their heads under the wiring of the fence. The NIDS veterinarian thought this was an unusual position for two animals to be in at death. There were few signs of struggle near the stinking animals. We looked carefully around the vicinity, and there were no marks. As we approached the animals, I noticed movement, and I was momentarily puzzled. At first, it looked like large white tarps or white plastic bags moving in the breeze near the cows' bellies. As we got closer, I realized that I was seeing a flowing river of millions of white, glistening maggots pouring from the abdomens of both carcasses. Watching them was like seeing a single giant organism writhe and swivel in and out of the abdominal cavities. Both cows had been dead about 48 hours, judging by the number of maggots. Forensic scientists agree that generally it takes only a couple of minutes after death for the first blowfly to land and lay eggs on the carcass of a dead animal. Within less than a day, the first maggots appear. Meanwhile, more blowflies quickly find the dead animal and rapidly repeat the egg-laying process. At the same time, the gas from the fermenting grass inside the rumen of the cow begins to expand and bloat the belly. In the high heat and high humidity of the Utah summer, this process happens very quickly. It is never a good idea to prod or kick the swollen, bloated abdomen of a dead cow. You might cause an extremely unpleasant and smelly explosion. Whether these two animals had died of natural or other causes was open to question, since no obvious tissues were missing, and the animals were far too decomposed to gain any biologically useful information from a necropsy. I was thankful for my previous experience of being around dead cows during my experimental work on cattle in a lab in France and on another stint at a large animal facility in Ottawa, Canada. But the physicist who accompanied us on the tour was not so fortunate. A career of writing software for NASA deep space missions had not prepared him for an up-close and personal encounter with 1,000 pounds of putrid, maggot-infested flesh. Within seconds, his face was turning a deep shade of gray, and I noticed his vain efforts to disguise the retching in the back of his throat. Tom took us to a small clearing about 100 yards west of the two dead cows. Even at this distance, the acrid smell still wafted on the slight breeze. Behind a few trees, we came upon 3 circles of very dried grass. All around the 20-foot diameter circles of the desiccated grass, tall, healthy green grass flourished in 3-foot-high swaths. This is where Tom's 3 dogs had been incinerated, he explained, still plainly upset by the memory. As we walked on, Tom pointed out the remains of 2 more cows that he said had been mutilated several months previously. A shell of weathered, tanned hide surrounded both carcasses. Each animal's bones were plainly visible, but their rear ends were missing. Since it was months after the fact, no useful information about the manner of their death could be ascertained. Tom explained that it had taken far longer than usual for the 2 carcasses to decompose. Usually, with the kind of temperatures and humidity in northeastern Utah, the carcasses would be bones within a few weeks. But it had taken almost a year to reduce these animals to this condition. Tom asked the veterinarian with us what could have slowed the rate of decomposition. The veterinarian shrugged. Perhaps a dramatic decrease in temperature or a chemical had killed off the putrefying bacteria. Neither seems very likely. It was easier to believe that Tom had got his facts wrong. This was not to be the last time that NIDS would underestimate what Tom told us. We walked on. 500 yards west, he showed us two circular deep holes in the ground where soil had been removed. Tom had found several of these deep indentations, usually following a night of flying lights. The holes were about a foot deep and several feet in diameter. They sloped downward from the edges. I guessed that 200 or 300 pounds of soil would have had to be removed from the ground in order to make those holes. I asked Tom if he had found soil nearby. He shook his head. He explained that the first time he had seen the holes, they had perfectly straight sides, as if a giant cookie cutter had dug in and removed the soil and grass. Over time, he explained, weathering and rain had blurred the precise cuts of the holes. Now, with the grass beginning to grow, the holes looked obvious, but less than spectacular. The NIDS plan was a simple one. Before anything could be accomplished, a validation process had to occur. A science team needed to personally experience the anomalous events. In other words, they had to see anomalous phenomena with their own eyes. That was the first order of business. We estimated that this phase would take a few weeks or months. Little did we know.